You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Brookings Institution and the Center on the United States and Europe to our event this morning. I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the center here. And we're really delighted today to have with us not only the former Prime Minister and current head of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for the European Parliament, the former Prime Minister of Belgium, that is, not to the Prime Minister of Europe. We haven't got there just yet, but that might be one of the things that we can talk about on the stage today. And also David Frum, one of the most prominent commentators here in Washington, D.C., from the Newsweek and Daily Beast. We're going to have a discussion today about a whole range of issues related to Europe, hoping to move past the current political crisis and into bigger discussions about EU-US relations. We've obviously had former Senator Kerry and new Secretary of State's visit to Europe with a whole host of different issues on the table. Lots of exciting things going on, from all kinds of questions about Italian elections to will the UK leave Europe? Will there be a new transatlantic free trade agreement? We've got a lot of things on the agenda. But our colleagues are going to interview each other. We're going to start with a brief presentation and an opening statement by Guy Verhofstadt. And then David Frum is going to take it from there and do what he usually does, which is give us a great set of questions and insights and guide the discussion, eventually into some participation from you, the audience. Now, unfortunately, Guy Verhofstadt has another event at 12:30, so we'll have to wrap up on the dot at 12:15. So we'll have to keep our watches at the ready. And so I will turn over without any further ado. But first, I'd also like to thank a couple of our colleagues who are in the audience. This is part of a series of events on Europe that we're doing with our colleagues across the way at CICE and the Centre for Transatlantic Relations. We have Anders Simony and Daniel Hamilton with us, and a whole host of other colleagues who are here. And we have been engaging with CICE for some time. We're planning a bridge across the road, a little bit like one of those rather ornate Italian-type bridges at some point when we raise the funding, of course, for that, to cement our relationship. We'd also like to thank the European Parliamentary Liaison Office here in Washington, D.C., and a number of our colleagues who are with us, who have made it possible for Guy Verhofstadt to be here with us today. So thank you very much to everyone. Prime Minister Verhofstadt and David Frum, over to you.
So thank you very much. First of all, you said it shall be a short introduction, but with a politician you never know, naturally, how short the introduction can be, but I do my best. And first of all, ladies and gentlemen, it's not the first time that I'm coming to Washington to give an introduction about the EU crisis, the crisis of the European Union, and what can we learn from the United States. I think it was 6 years ago, was at that moment Prime Minister of Belgium. I made a speech in Washington about the same topic. It was not before such a prestigious institution as Brookings. It was CSIS. I hope that there are no people of CIS in the room now. So today I'm back in a quite different context, I should say, because compared to 6 years ago, yes, the European Union is in the midst of a serious crisis, and I shall not give you a whole overview of everything what happened the last years in Europe, but you have certainly followed the Greek crisis that started in December 2009, the Portuguese financial crisis in 2010, the Irish debt crisis also in that same year, then problems in Madrid, in Spain, problems in Italy. So we have to recognize that since the outbreak of the financial crisis in 2008, we are in the midst of a number of serious problems. And the question that I want to raise with you this morning is, what went wrong in the European Union? What is the reason that there is a crisis in the European Union? Because you don't find it in other parts of the world. You can say that there is no growth worldwide if you look to a number of figures of a number of regions. Why? What is happening exactly in the Union? And what is going wrong? I put this question as a convinced European, somebody who believes in a more integrated, I shall use the word, a federal Europe, because as many of you will know, we have also many people in Europe that believe that it is the existence of the Union itself that is the problem, and certainly not the solution to our crisis. They would rather retreat behind their national borders, as it was the case in the 19th century, in a world of old-style powers, old-style nation-states. And in fact, many of these people then understand that this world definitely does not longer exist, and that its 19th and 20th century is clearly behind us. I'm always saying when your President Barack Obama cannot deal himself with climate change, cannot settle himself trade agreements with, for example, China, what chances are there for any single European country to achieve this on its own? And moreover, I'm always giving the example of what shall be the G8 in 30 years of now, in 2040, something like that. G8 shall be the US, Japan, China, India, Brazil, Russia. I've given six names now, and the last two, there shall be Indonesia and Mexico, and one single European country. Nevertheless, I think that the challenges are huge. It are our societies that at our stake, our principles, our way of life that counts in this world of tomorrow. And I think it's certainly necessary that the two big continental blocks, Europe and the US, are working together. 1/7 of the world population, still 50% of world's GDP, also two continents that share the same freedom. But let me return to my initial question. What went really wrong in the European Union? Well, I think that mainly when we talk about our problems, we have to talk about the Eurozone, where we made, by establishing this Eurozone, a number of fundamental mistakes. We created, as you know, a monetary union, but we not install at that moment an economic union, a fiscal union, a banking union. And today we all know that it is impossible that a single currency with 17 different governments, 17 different bond markets, 17 different economic strategies, that it simply cannot work. I'm always saying maybe a state can exist without a currency. There are a number of examples of that. But there was never a currency, and there is no currency in the actual world without a state. A state authority that can guarantee the economic, financial, and political conditions to sustain the currency. Nevertheless, the European decision makers 13 years ago thought exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. They thought that it was possible to introduce the euro without the necessary means and tools, and that all these necessary means and tools should become spontaneously a reality. In a nutshell, they thought that it was possible to have a single currency, the euro, based on especially two specific rules, two basic rules. The first, and you know them, no public debts higher than 60%, and secondly, no fiscal deficits higher than 3%. And do not get me wrong, these rules are sound, I do not criticize them, but the founding fathers of the Eurozone made the mistake not to foresee, in my opinion, a public authority at the Eurozone level to impose them. A public authority strong enough to prevent member states from breaching them. A public authority with the necessary means and tools to sanction them and to penalize the sinners. They thought that the sinners should penalize themselves. What is, in my opinion, certainly in politics, a very naive opinion. So that was not the only mistake, naturally, we made. Every time the stock markets are going up and the so-called spreads down, many in the European Union believe that the crisis is over. And I think it's sufficient to see the effect of the elections in Italy to realize that this is completely wrong, It's enough that a single election goes badly for the markets to react immediately with a number of devastating consequences across the Union. And you have followed that in 24 hours. The spreads for Italy went up 100 basic points. That's 1% more than just before the election, and with contagion to other markets, to Portugal, to Spain, and so on. So the crisis around the euro crisis, is not over. And this crisis, in my opinion, and that's my message of today, this crisis needs a structural solution, an in-depth solution and reform, because despite endless meetings since the outbreak of the crisis in December 2009, the European heads of states and government have, in fact, in my opinion, not been able to agree to such a structural solution. And moreover, in my opinion, that is because they are, in fact, unable to do so, not made to do so. The European Council, that is in the middle now of the decision-making inside the European Union, is in fact, in my opinion, not made to govern Europe or to manage the euro area. And moreover, I think that the European Council does not even represent the interest, the general interest of the European Union. It represents mainly the amalgamated interests of individual member states. It's a little bit, if I can make this comparison, as if the United States was to be run by the 50 state governors. So you imagine that, no Obama, no American administration, not at all, even Capitol Hill can disappear, not completely, but at least partially. And you have then the 50 governors alone coming together, 5-6 times a year, that have to provide the policies for the United States. Do we enter Iraq, yes or no? You remember, and with the 50 state governors around the table, what we do to make the dollar more sustainable, and all this by unanimity. And you know better than I do, I think, that unanimity is certainly not the best way to govern a country, and even less a continent. And that was already a lesson understood by your founding fathers over 200 years ago. Unanimity kills any, in my opinion, real capacity to make real change. And besides this ineffective way of governance and the lack of real sanctions to ensure fiscal discipline, we have also made, if I can give the complete analysis, a third fundamental mistake when we launched the euro. I call it the other side of the coin. If fiscal discipline is one side of the coin, you need another side, and it's then solidarity. Without solidarity, a monetary union can simply not exist. It's in fact the essence of a monetary community, and it's clear that such a form of solidarity can take different forms. It can be a monetary fund. It can be by the way of a partial mutualization of debts or by common issuance of sovereign bonds, you know, the way Hamilton did it more than 200 years ago. Or finally, it can also be done by a serious federal budget, so a budget that can finance common policies and can be the basis for that currency. Well, the main problem in Europe is that none of all this exists in Europe. Besides two limited rescue funds, you know them, the European Financial Stability Facility, that is a temporary rescue fund that has been created in 2010, and besides the more permanent European Stability Mechanism, the ESM, what is the follow-up of the EFSF, besides that, there is in fact nothing at all. The only thing what we have is a budget of 1%. And let's be honest, European budget of 1%, I compare it with the 24% in the US. Nevertheless, not always difficult and not always easy to agree on the 24% apparently, but it's not this 1% that can make any difference. And moreover, the lack of a real independent revenue inside the Union makes the Union, how I should call it, a hostage from the member states. And we all know, if we want to tackle the problems in the European Union, we need a bigger budget with a direct income for the Union, so that the Union itself decides on what needs to be funded, and so that you can also establish what is normal, what is the evidence in a true democracy, a direct link between the citizens and your public authority in your country. So that they can see what they pay for. That can be a federal VAT, value added tax, as exists here in the US. That can be a carbon tax, a financial transaction tax. Ladies and gentlemen, in any way, you need some real direct funding of your federal authority to be credible and to be effective. So a union that does not work well because of ineffective governance is not only an institutional issue, not only an institutional problem. It is, in fact, people and economies that suffer most from it. And let me give you one example. I'm very convinced about that. Had the European leaders, for example, decided in December 2009 to help Greece immediately, and then they should have established, for example, at that moment in December 2009, a new surveillance mechanism of their budget in exchange for greater financial support, I think we would not be in the crisis we are today in Europe. And also, I think that many millions of people would not have suffered. But because we have given the impression that we could kick out one of the members, yeah, then a monetary union not longer really exists. And so the price of inaction and the cost of ineffective institutions in the European Union is for the moment very high. Too high in my opinion, and see what it does, for example, for the moment in Italy, with half of the population voting for two populist parties, and what is what happened. One party, the party of Berlusconi, that created the mess, I should say, and the other populist party, the party of Beppe Grillo, that is simply opposed to politics, opposed to the system. Or look, if you want, to another example, to Greece, where extreme populist, even outright fascist parties emerge for the moment. So my clear message of today is that we must change drastically the way we govern Europe. We must, in my opinion, the fastest as possible, introduce what I call the federal way, because federalism guarantees not only the respect of differences, it provides also mechanisms for taking decisions by majority, ensuring democracy, ensuring effectiveness and transparency. And then the question is, what does it mean for the European Union, such a change in a federal system? In my opinion, four building blocks. First of all, the establishment of a true European government, what doesn't exist for the moment, that should be, in fact, a drastically reformed European Commission. Secondly, what you need is a true European Treasury, with a Treasury Minister at his head. It should be, third, a federal democratic control with the European Senate, a second chamber representing the states, to work naturally together with the European Parliament representing the European citizens. And fourth, also a common European bond market, and we could start with what we call a European Collective Redemption Fund. That is the idea to mutualize debts above the 60% mark, to create a big liquid market of 3 trillion of euro, and that would be a real game changer that should convince the markets. In short, when I give you these four building blocks, and you're American, you say, yeah, that's exactly what we did in the 18th century, more or less. And you started in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, in 1781 with the Articles of the Confederation, still based on unanimity, and then in 1787, the big change, the Convention of Philadelphia, in which the Articles of the Confederation were fundamentally changed in a real federation, with Article 7 stipulating that an approval by 9 of the 13 states was sufficient to approve the Constitution and bring it into force. And then 1790, the Hamilton moment. We are still waiting on our Hamilton moment the European Union. The first head of the Treasury who introduced Treasury certificates after a huge battle with Thomas Jefferson, but also fruitful for Thomas Jefferson because Washington had been created in that deal at that moment. And then it's only later, in 1792, with the Coinage Act, that the single currency was established, and only in 1913 that the Federal Reserve System emerged. So the historic development in the US is quite clear. We are more intelligent in Europe. We do exactly the opposite. We start with a single currency, and then we say, oh, shit, we have a problem. We don't have an economic union, a fiscal union. The banking union is not there. We have no sanctions. There is the difference with what's happened here. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think that we need the fastest as possible to make this new federal system in Europe. And also for our American counterparts, because only a unified Europe based on the example of our American counterparts can be a long-term and reliable partner for the US. It's in fact the choice between the disjointed efforts of 27 small states or a single solid partner. And I think that in the globalized world of tomorrow, the interest of the United States is to work with a single solid partner at the other side of the Atlantic Ocean and not 27 different member states. And I think also that this cooperation can ensure that our values and principles become the benchmark across the world. And that's the reason why I'm, and that's my conclusion, I very strongly support the free trade agreement between the US and the, UA, the EU. It's clearly, I think, in the interest of both. It would lead to an increase of 100 billion euros in the GDP of the European Union to approximately the same figure, 90 billion in the US. It should lead also to an increase of exports of both continents. The forecasts are 6 and 8% of increase for both. So I think, and that's my end, I think we have all interest, first of all, for an adept reform of the European Union and as fast as possible this trade agreement and cooperation between the two blocs. And to end, ladies and gentlemen, I want to end with a quote of what you do otherwise in Washington than with the quote of George Washington, because he was not only your first president, but he was also a European visionary. He wrote in a letter 200 years ago, in a letter to his European friend, the Marquis of Lafayette, the following sentence. It's interesting to repeat it for you. I am a citizen, I'm quoting him, I am a citizen of the greatest republic of mankind. I see the human race united like a huge family by brotherly ties. We have made a sowing of liberty which will little by little spring up across the whole world. And one day on the model of the United States of America, a United States of Europe will come into being. The United States of Europe will legislate for all its nationalities. Well, you can say that he was well ahead of his time, George Washington, even by today's standards. Certainly when I'm comparing him with the actual Prime Minister of Britain, Mr. Cameron, he's well away ahead. But George Washington was convinced that no matter what, the Europeans will come together, will form this United States of Europe. And let's be honest, this was thinking outside the box, eh? You can say that, certainly in the 18th century. And few would have thought that there is a chance for that to happen. But there are also people like Jean Monnet, Robert Schuman, who saw, in fact, the United States as the source of inspiration. In all difficult moments, the United States of America have opted for more cooperation, more federalism, and having done so, not only it survived, but it flourished as never before. Well, let's take a lesson to that. The same is necessary for Europe, certainly in the globalized world of tomorrow. Thank you for your attention.
Prime Minister, thank you for your very lucid and candid remarks. And on behalf of the inhabitants of Washington, D.C., thank you, too, for your compliment of suggesting there are any lessons for Europe to learn from American governance. We think we are setting world records in dysfunctionality here. it's impressive to hear that that anyone thinks that we have anything positive to offer. You stated very emphatically and very clearly the requirements for a successful monetary union, a common government, common treasury, fiscal policy, banking policy. None of those were in place, as you say, when the euro was launched. In that case, was it not reckless and irresponsible to launch the euro? Is this not like saying, I want to go to sea, and I know I'm going to need water, food, fuel, and maps. I have no water, food, fuel, and maps, and I'm going to sea anyway.
I agree with you, but you have to understand why it has been established, this euro. This euro was not an economic project, was not a financial project. It was a political project, a pure political project. After the fall of the Soviet Union, a deal was made between France and Germany, between François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl. And François Mitterrand said, okay, because you remember that period, there were all, even under Western European leaders, ideas to create two democratic Germanies at that moment. I think that even Mitterrand played a long time with that idea. I think a stupid idea, but at that time, that was in the air. And finally, Mitterrand understand that it was impossible to go against this trend of unification of Germany. And he asked for that a price. And the price was, okay, I shall ask for a common currency and then to establish really Germany in the middle of that monetary union so that never again, Germany can break away of the system. That's the reason why we created it. That euro, why we introduced it, the euro. It has been prepared in an appropriate way, no problem with that. The launch was, in fact, a success in most of the countries, but the problems emerge immediately in the sense that if you don't have an economic fiscal union and only this a number of rules, this is not sufficient. It's maybe sufficient in a time of economic growth and the beginning, 2000, 2010, and 7, there was 5, 6, 7 years, no problems, low interest rates in the European Union, everybody benefiting of that. And then comes the financial crisis, naturally. Financial crisis that emerged and that created not only a non-problem, but a non-debt problem in a number of countries. And because it is the main reason of this increasing debts since 2007 in the European Union, like it was also the case in a certain way in the US. And so at that moment, what you see is that you don't have your economic union, you don't have your fiscal union, the only thing what you have are a number of rules that have not been applied by whom? By the two big countries in 2003, 2004. The first two members of the Eurozone who don't apply the fiscal deficit rule of 3% are France and Germany. And they are saying, yeah, but there are exceptional circumstances, and in monetary issues there are always exceptional circumstances, and so we cannot apply them. And that created, in fact, the sentiment, not only inside, but also to the markets, that this was not real, built on sound policies
a sound economic and a fiscal union. And then you have, naturally, in December 2009, what happened really is very simple to explain, because the public finances from Greece were already very bad, I should say, years and years. But what happened was that the rating agencies downgraded Greek bonds to BBB+, should be very good today, but at that moment, BBB+ was a real problem. And at the same time, the European Central Bank announced an exit strategy that meant that she should not longer accept BBB+ as collateral for liquidity for the bank. So everybody had in his portfolio a number of bonds that not longer could be used as a collateral, sold that, and the crisis, in fact, was born.
The euro may not have been an economic project at the inception, but it had economic consequences from the inception, and those consequences have been catastrophic. The worst economic disaster to strike the European continent since the Great Depression. Millions of people out of work, millions of people losing assets. And those consequences showed up immediately. As you say, those low interest rates created a tremendous incentive for people in the southern part of the continent to borrow and import, and it created an incentive for people in northern Europe to export. From the beginning, France saw its share of world trade collapse. From the beginning, Germany saw its share of world trade rise, mostly at the expense of France. Now we see a continent with unemployment rates of Great Depression level across the bottom half. It's a calamity. It's a catastrophe. People are turning on their political leaders, and those political leaders are saying, "What did we do? Why are you blaming us?" Should not we begin with kind of a moment of accountability and responsibility that said the euro was a terrible mistake, and at this point we have only bad options, and the people who created this mistake need to be held to account?
But first of all, are people thinking like that about the euro? If you every poll on the euro, Greece or in Spain or in Italy or in Portugal, has a convincing 70 to 75% rate in favor for the euro. Greek citizens and Spanish citizens aren't stupid, or Italians certainly not. They're saying, if I lose tomorrow the euro, we go back to the old policies of our political predecessors. You know what it was. That was every 2 years a devaluation of the local currency, of the lira, of the drachma, to regain competitiveness because of a lack of reform in the country. And who is paying the bill in a devaluation? A normal citizen, who is in fact losing purchasing power. And that was happening every 2 years. And that's the reason, because it's very, it's a contradiction even, that they have enormous difficulties with what is Europe asking. And at the same time, if in a poll you ask, what do you want? Do you want to continue with the euro, the single currency? They say, yes, I want to continue with the single currency. So the problem is not the euro as such. The problem is a lack of reform in a number of countries, in mainly the south, but not only in the south. Take France, for example, of the European Union. And what is helping now is that the euro can create a pressure to all these countries to reform and to do what is necessary, and not to do what they did in the past, because that's not longer possible. They have not longer their local currency to devaluate and to regain competitiveness in that way. Was the euro a good initiative? First of all, it was politically certainly a wise decision. It was not well prepared, that we discussed it already. But a number of countries had an enormous advantage of it. Countries like Belgium, my country, or the Netherlands, certainly Germany, but also a number of other countries. All monetary borders were abolished. I can give you a figure for a country. It's not my country, but the Netherlands. The Netherlands... Because why? Because there was an election, we have followed that maybe, 6-7 months ago, in which a political party, extreme right wing of Mr. Wilders, said, we want to get rid of this euro. We want to get out of the eurozone. That was his bid in the election. And he lost 1/3 of his electorate in the election. Why? Because the Dutch are not stupid, you know, something about figures and so on. Some people said even too much. And there were analysis showing that from all financial institutions and so, showing that if the Dutch should go outside the euro system, there should be an economic downturn three times bigger as the collapse of Lehman had had its effect on the Dutch economy. Why? Because it's an export-oriented country.
So you've created, though, to us it sometimes seems that what Europe has built is something like the doomsday machine from Dr. Strangelove, a giant explosive mass under the continent that will kill you all if you get rid of it quickly, but is killing you all slowly. I mean, it's true. It used to be that in Italy people would lose 2 or 3 or 5 or 6% of their purchasing power every year. Now the unemployed lose 100% of their purchasing power all at once, and not just for 1 year, but for year after year after year. And in the case, we're now closing on half a decade of mass unemployment, 50% for young people in Spain and Greece. People in Spain, we are seeing the beginnings of emigration. It's true, the Dutch and the Belgians and the Germans have profited hugely. And their suggestion for the way to solve the problems is that all the people who are suffering must change, and all the people who have benefited get to stay the way they are.
There I agree with you. That's what I said, that is the other side of the coin, what I was talking about. That is that my criticism to actual policies in the European Union is that they only tackle the question of fiscal discipline. That's absolutely necessary. I'm a former Minister of Budget. That was when I was young. I started as Minister of Budget with a fiscal deficit of 16% of the general government in Belgium and with a 137% of debt of GDP. So we know what we are talking about, how to manage it. So fiscal discipline is absolutely necessary for growth in the long term. But if you, for the moment, and that is what is happening, you do only fiscal discipline and you don't organize also solidarity, growth, investment in a certain way on the European level, you have the mess we have today and the problems we have today with massive unemployment in Portugal, in Spain, as you indicated. And that's the problem for the moment. That is that the European leaders see the fiscal discipline as one huge principle to have a sustainable union. They don't, for the moment, enough recognize the other side of the coin, and that's the solidarity. And that means, in my opinion, or a bigger budget, or a European bond market, or a mutualization of debt, partially of globally. And why? Because then you can create a market, you can attract savings, you can launch investment in Europe, what we desperately need. Let me give you an example to show you what the problem is. An example of a small country, so I'm not talking about Spain, not about Italy, so I'll talk about a country that is nearly fully compliant with the Stability Pact, Slovenia. Small country, 2 million people, less than 60% debt, so compliant with the Stability Pact. They have a fiscal deficit between 3 and 4%, so it's not the best pupil of the class, but there are much more problems in other countries. You know what they are paying as interest rate? 5.66% was their last financing cost for the government. And they put it in dollar on the market, not even in euro. Otherwise, they had paid more than 5.66%. So a country fully compliant, but fully, nearly compliant with the Stability Pact. Why? Small market. Who is interested? Are there people here with Slovenian bonds or something? I don't think so. Because it is a small market with no liquidity. There is a basic principle that all these leaders in Europe have forgotten. In bond markets, it's liquidity what counts. The higher the liquidity, the lower the rates. Even before the financial crisis, the rate interest rate in the U.S. was lower than the interest rate in Germany. Before the financial crisis, I'm not talking about the actual situation. Nevertheless, the public finances of Germany are far better than those of the U.S. Why? Because liquidity. The bond market in Germany is 1 trillion. The bond market in the U.S. is 10 trillion. That's the difference in size, and that's also the difference in interest rate. And the second point is you don't have a credible authority behind. The problem is a structural problem. It's not only a question of a structural problem. You have no real common strategy that can oblige member states to do the reforms that are necessary. And that creates also this increase in interest rates. I'm always comparing with Japan.
But isn't
226% and the lowest interest rates worldwide.
Isn't one of the reasons that the United States and Japan, despite their fiscal problems, have such low interest rates, is that no investor doubts...
Exactly. That confidence.
No investor doubts that if worse comes to worse, the Japanese government can make yen and the United States government can make dollars. But the Slovenian government can't make euros. And that is what they're being punished for. I mean, that you have this... the vision you present is one in which you say people will be punished until they reform. Do you worry about what that means for the stability of European democracies? We are seeing in, you mentioned Greece, we are seeing on the fringes of Europe, we are seeing in some countries backsliding away from democracy. The patience of the Spanish people is almost superhuman, but there are limits to everything. Italy has had a protest. It seems so far to be not a protest with a lot of content, but it is an expression of repudiation of political leaders. And who can blame them?
No, I think this is already not only a euro crisis, but a crisis of the union as such, and political, and not only financial or economic. But you have to make the good analysis. Is the good or the good conclusion? What is the good conclusion from that? To go back to nation states? To go back to 17 different markets? To 17 nations with their own currency, with their own... I don't think so. In the globalized world of tomorrow, it seems not to be a good choice to make, to go back to nation states. No, you have to go do your work and go further in your integration and then do everything what is necessary. Well, and for example, that means... that you have to oblige, for example, countries like Italy to change their labor market. Because if they don't change their labor market, there is an increase in their rates that puts pressure on the euro and that puts a political problem in the union. The fact that there is an obligation to do reforms in all this country. And why? Because you have a common currency, a common destiny, and a common economy. So the question is, what is we know what the problems are. The question is, what way we go? We go back to a loose confederation of 27? I don't buy it. I think that's the wrong choice to make in the globalized world of tomorrow. Or you go further in what is a normal way of thinking. Yeah, you need to integrate. Because difference in the U.S., there are also. But... with not the same consequences. If, for example, California goes bankrupt, it's not that the whole American system is collapsing and the dollar is disappearing. If a small economy like Greece, only representing 2% of the European GDP, has a problem, the whole system is in shock because of the lack of a real federal system.
But when you talk about going forward, what that would mean, if you were really to do it, if you were to follow the American example, the Hamiltonian project and all that's come after, that would mean that taxpayers in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Germany would say, we accept to be fully responsible, if need be, for the pensions and health care of people in Portugal, Greece, Slovenia, Poland, when they join. We will pay, if need be, the way people in Connecticut today are responsible for all of the obligations. And I'm not talking about government debt. I'm talking about the social welfare system of Kentucky and Texas. Is there any sign that your taxpayers in Belgium would say, yes, we agree to pay the pensions of people in Greece, we agree to pay the health care of people in Greece? And if they won't do that, then your fiscal system won't exist, and therefore, by your own description, your money system must be a failure.
Well, in fact, they are paying now for it. That is what's happening.
Your fiscal transfers are, 2% of European GDP? I mean, our federal government moves, an insurance company with an army. Our federal government moves around, right now it's more, but historically about 20%. It's vast. Kentucky would not have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid on its own. It couldn't possibly afford them. It's paid for by the people of Connecticut and California and other states.
Well, it is
If I can come back a little bit to the pure financial problems, because there we are paying. Yeah? So the taxpayers of the North, taxpayers in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Germany, are paying for the moment to these rescue funds. And because of the rescue funds, we can give sustainable lower interest rates to these countries to finance their public debts. That's happening now. What I'm saying is there are maybe more intelligent ways to do it. That is by mutualization of debt. Under strict conditions, then you pay less interest rate to the bondholders. Now what we are doing is that we are asking money to taxpayers, we give it to Italy, Spain, Portugal, and they pay these high interest rates to bondholders, mainly outside the European Union. So I think that there is a more logic way to solve the problem, the Hamilton way, that is that you mutualize partially, and that you pay less interest rates on Italian bonds, Spanish bonds, because they are mutualized in a European framework. So that these bondholders receive less interest rate. That costs less taxpayers' money. That said, if you develop a federal budget of a certain size, you have automatic transfers inside. Or people against it in any way, not the Dutch was I talking about. They knew very well, the question was very simple. Do you agree, yes or no, to help more the Greeks? And I can tell you, in a climate and an environment, what was very bad. Because everybody said, no, the Greeks, they don't work. There's always sun there. They have a good pension. They have never paid for that. All stories that most of them are not true or not completely true. But that was the image of that. Well, they said, no, we go for it. We don't want to lose this euro. If we have to be in a certain part more solidar with them, we shall do it. Because we gain also from all this. So you can explain it to people. You can explain that it's not in their interest that the euro disappears and that there is a mess in the south of Europe, because their markets, it's their markets. The logistic firms of the Dutch are exporting to what? To Greece, to Italy, to Spain. You know, you have to see the figures of Germany, for example. You have raised yourself when you were talking about the enormous gain of the euro for Germany. Well, it's true. Germany had a balanced trade balance with Greece before the introduction of the euro. Now they have an enormous, excellent surplus in their trade balance with Greece. So they knew it. They are not stupid. They are saying if we destroy that system, we destroy also the engine of our wealth. So, there is nothing free in the world. So if you want to gain on your export markets, you have to be a little bit more solider on your transfers.
I will now turn to the audience for questions. I will reserve the right to ask the last one, but we have 25 minutes before the Prime Minister must go to his next appointment. Sir, in the orange vest.
Hi, my name is Oliver Grimm. I'm a U.S. correspondent for an Austrian newspaper here in D.C. I was in Brussels before for 4 years. Don't we, in fact, already have that sort of treasury in Europe? You've got the ESM, and you've got an ECB president who says it will do whatever it takes to, keep things going. So why don't we simply double the ESM? At some point after the German elections, we might get Ms. Merkel and her coalition partners to agree, and then we could even face an Italian problematic situation where the ESM would step in. Because currently the ESM, of course, would be too small. I mean, it's kind of an improvised solution, but I don't really see where your big quantum leap should come from with that set of politicians we have. Thanks.
Well, let me first of all say that Italian debt is 2 trillion. Huh? So even when you double the ESM, you have not enough for that. Secondly, ESM is a typical system of what I said and what I have criticized, a rescue fund where you take taxpayers' money and you give it to a country to pay a high interest rate, mainly paid outside the union. So you pay the interest rate of 5%, of 6%, of 7% because of the crisis. In the mutualization system, that's not the ESM, that's a collective redemption fund or a Eurobond or a system of Eurobills, of treasury certificates, the Hamilton way. There you don't pay 5, 6 or 7%. You shall pay 2.5%, 3%, shall be a little bit more,
than what you pay on a German Bund, but not what we have today. So it's a far more, I should say, cost-effective system to deal with your problems. It's huge also, right? It's 3 trillion, a collective redemption fund, when we talk about all the debts, about 60%. So that's the reason why I think that's a far better system than simply a rescue fund. And a rescue fund, ESM, is intergovernmental. We shall see how it works. Because every time when there is a country that is opposed to something, they can block it, an ESM. It's intergovernmental, so you need unanimity. Secondly, we can no longer also continue with the OMT. The OMT was absolutely necessary. The outright measures that have been proposed and launched on the 6th of September by Draghi. But my fear is that it has not only taken pressure away from the market, it has also taken pressure away from the politicians to do what is necessary. Because they say, oh, Mr. Draghi, if there is a problem, he shall buy bonds in whatever quantity of a country in difficulty. And that is what the OMT mainly is doing. Also, that is, if it is used, a very cost-ineffective system, and that is not sustainable on the long term. Only sustainable system on the long term is a mutualization, a common bond market that can lower the interest rates.
We're going to take questions in bulk at this point. We're going to take 2 from this side of the room and then 2 from that side of the room. So there's one in the back corner, sir, in the back there, and then Ambassador Simonyi, and then I'll direct you 2, and then I have 2 over here that I'll take after that.
Jeffrey Stacey from CTR SAIS. 2 questions, Mr. Verhofstadt, one economic and one more foreign policy related, if I may. Would you agree that American observers who sort of like to now say, I told you so, and have all sorts of schadenfreude to say to their European counterparts these days, would you agree that they could be usefully reminded by you of the decades of benefits of first the customs union and the free trade area, then the single market, then the single currency and single monetary policy, that there were broad and wide benefits for Europeans for years and years for these things. But then I'd like to ask you another question. Lately, you've seen European countries, including your own, and in particular Britain and France, act in a military fashion outside of the European framework, somewhat successfully, or even very successfully, to observers here. Certainly my former colleagues at the State Department are now pleased with these things, and after the Libya operation view these options as being positive, new options on the table in an era of austerity. Presumably you're in favor of combining European armed forces. Could you say something about that for us?
And Ambassador Simon.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be representing one of the co-hosts. But I'd like to come back to a question that David raised. And this is about related to the backsliding of democracy. I mean, while we have a huge crisis in Europe, it seems to me that there are strange ideas, strange economic ideas, but also the unraveling of the checks and balances in some countries. And I just want you to address this. I mean, how is Europe going to deal with this? I don't think you can deal with the economic crisis first and then move on, and we'll deal with the deficit in democracy second, because we might really have a major, major issue. It's no secret. My own country, Hungary, is backsliding with the checks and balances, and some politicians even look to Vladimir Putin as their role models and being excited about the alternative. That's a pretty scary thing, but I want you to answer that.
Yeah, maybe on the first question, I'm very much in favor indeed of a more integrated Europe, not only on monetary issues, economic issues, tax issues, but also on foreign policy and defense. I hosted as Prime Minister what has been called afterwards, a little bit cynical, the Chocolate Summit. It was in Brussels, so that's the reason why they call it the Chocolate Summit. That was in 2003, where we launched a number of
common policies on defense, a common European headquarters, for example, to launch our operations when we have military operations outside the European Union. And it's, in my opinion, one of the priorities to do in the coming years. Also for reasons of public finances, I should say. Because what Europeans, what is Europe military? Well, Europe are 27 states who are spending between 40 and 45% of the American military expenditure. So that's a lot of money. You can say, oh, it's not so much. It's only 40, 45% of the American expenditures. But that's a lot of money, and only we can do 10% of the operations of the American army. So if I do my mathematics good, that means that we are 4 to 5 times less effective than the American army. That's normal, because you do 27 times the same thing. And you are not integrated, neither the Navy, neither strategic transport, neither intelligence, name it, you name it. So it's 27 times the same. There are a number of small corporations, but they are really not counting at all. So defense is certainly the key, and it can help to reduce the deficit, and at the same time you create your community. I'm always saying how to have a common foreign policy. Well, for a common foreign policy you need the diplomacy that is common, and you need a common army. Then you're obliged to have a common foreign policy. I was member of the European Council when in 2003 I raised the question in Spain. It was in Sevilla in Barcelona, the summit in Sevilla in Barcelona, the Spanish presidency. And I asked, dear colleagues, should we not discuss a possible invasion of the U.S. in Iraq and what our position is? That was the question. And Chirac took the floor and he said, I don't think that it's interesting because we don't agree. Is it not, Tony? Yes, Jacques, we don't agree, so it's not necessary. So, point. 1 minute, that was a discussion on Iraq in the European Council. That is the foreign policy of the Union on a huge issue, I think. Yeah? Still a huge issue of the invasion in Iraq. So if you want to change that, you need first of all the instruments. Because if you have the common instruments, then you are obliged to do so. But I'm very much in favor to go in that direction. Maybe you could already show that in Syria, where we do nothing at all, what is a shame for the moment, that we are not capable to develop whatsoever policy. And then on deficit in democracy, that's true. We have a whole system, values, even a procedure, how we have to tackle problems with a lack of democracy inside the Union, that's inside the Lisbon Treaty. They are, in my opinion, far too complicated, with too high thresholds before the Union, in fact, can act. Four-fifth and all these, a four-fifth majority before you can denounce a number of things on that issue. So I believe that we have to develop that the fastest as possible, and that we need to have the courage to tackle them, because that's a problem. We have an intergovernmental system, and you know how it's working in an intergovernmental system. I explained it a little bit, making a completely idiotic comparison with the 50 state governors coming together. But if you have these 27 coming together, you know how it's working. They are never pointing the finger to another. Maybe they need the other tomorrow to make a deal. A deal on the budget, for example, because also the budget is made by these 27 heads of states and government. And that is the main problem. You need in a system based on a government, an elected parliament, a Senate representing the states, and they have to have the full power to not only govern Europe, but also to sanction those countries who are not fulfilling their obligations under the treaty. Mm-hmm. And not to give this to heads of states and government.
We're going to take two questions here in the second row. These two gentlemen here.
Thank you very much. My name is Anders Åslund. I'm at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I very much welcome your strong advocacy for a federal Europe. And my question to you is, how would you concretely try today to convene a relevant group of people who would push forward this? What way forwards do you see? Thank you.
And the gentleman immediately to your left.
Thank you very much. Matthias Matthies, I'm a professor of political economy at SAIS across the street, and also from Ghent, the prime minister's native city in Belgium.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to see you here with the same energy as when you turned prime minister in 99 when I was a college student, and it's great to have you in Washington. I want to follow up on Ambassador Simoni's question on legitimacy. If you look at the UK now, they're doing austerity, but it's their choice. They chose this policy, they continue it. They might not like it, but it seems to me, who is Olly Rehn, one of your Belgian natives, former ministers of the federal government asked. And now again, Olly Rehn says, well, no matter what the Italians do in the elections, they will have to continue with the reforms Europe asks them to do. So I wonder, when it comes to legitimacy, isn't it still the case somehow that it remains mainly with the nation state, that people see our government chose, and we can vote them out if we don't like it, but at least we follow what we chose rather than what Europe tells us to do. Thank you.
Yeah, that's mainly the problem. You cannot have a common currency and then a loose coordination of your economic policies. The other possibility is that you have a big budget. If you have a big budget, 24%, then these common policies are the basis for your currency. You don't have it, because 1%, let's be honest, is not 1%, because 39% of this 1% is going to CAP, to Common Agriculture Policy. So if you look really to the amount available for common policies beyond the Common Agriculture Policy, yeah, it's a 0.6% of the European GDP. So it's not with zero. That's the reason why we need full discipline and solidarity, and we need to go in the same direction. That's the reason why. If you could have a big budget in Europe, you don't need to have these stability pact rules in the same way as we have them now. So a loose coordination of economic policies doesn't work. That we have seen. I was there 10 years. Lisbon strategy, 2020 strategy. We shall become the most competitive, knowledged economy of the world. That was the objective. Printing paper, yeah, that it was. It was nothing else than that. Best practices, peer review, benchmarks. Forget it. That's not working at all. That's one bad moment in your parliament with your bad results, and then the next day you go further. So that's the reason why we need what I call convergence policy. Convergence policy is, in my opinion, the step that we have to make in the coming 2 years inside the Economic and Monetary Union. Convergence policy is like deciding on a motorway. And on this motorway, not too narrow, but not a real motorway where you can have 10 cars at the same time, but you have a left side and a right side. The left side is to avoid social dumping. The right side is to guarantee your competitiveness. It's a motorway defining minimum and maximum values. And every country, every economy inside the euro has to follow that path. It's not harmonization. They can choose what they want. They can take the left side, they can take the right side, but they have all to go in the same direction, not what's happening now, a German truck at one side and a Greek car coming from the other side, I should say. But that happened now, divergence of European economies. They have to convert the European economies. And if necessary, you give them sticks for that, you give them carrots for that, but you need to do that. And what is then the responsibility on the democratic level? The responsibility is still in the nation states for the implementation of this convergence policy. And what is the democratic accountability of the motorway as such? That's on the European level. And that exists. A European Parliament is elected. I was elected. I got 600,000 votes in the last election in my constituency, that's a good English word, thank you, Guillaume, in my constituency, and But the problem is that we have to develop this. Who is Olli Rehn? Yeah, Olli Rehn is a member of the commission. He's Finnish. He has a lot of humor. You don't think so, but he has a lot of humor. I can tell you. I know him personally, even being Finnish. And that said, we need to change the system so that there is a real democratic accountability. And you need transnational lists, and you have to have people, an elected president of the commission, so that he is responsible before the public opinion. What is the case also in any country, like in the US, if you go for senator, yeah, you have also responsibility, not to talk about the president elected by everybody. Then on the first issue, how to convince people, because this is a jump forward. This is not little steps. I think there are two things. First of all, we need, again, European politicians who are developing a vision about this and going to these elections in 2014 defending that vision. I always think that politicians can create public opinions. That is not so that, unfortunately, politicians have always to follow public opinions. It's not true. People are looking to politicians, are listening to politicians. And if a politician can develop a vision, I think that he can create also a public opinion for it. Certainly in this environment of today, because of the euro crisis, people again a number of people say, yeah, maybe more European integration is what we need. Otherwise, it's not possible to have a common currency. So there are many people say, oh, let's hope that the crisis is tomorrow over. I hope also that the crisis is tomorrow over. But this crisis helps to create a European public opinion who is aware of the problem and who is saying, oh, we need. You have the opposite, naturally also, the Eurosceptics, the nationalists, the populists, who are telling to the people we have to retreat behind our national borders to protect ourselves in the globalized world. And I think there is a case to make in 2014 with success to say exactly the opposite. You need to regain your sovereignty on the European level. Don't longer listen to those who say, oh, national sovereignty, we lose our national sovereignty. It no longer exists, national sovereignty in Europe. It does not longer exist because of the euro. Ask to the Greeks what national sovereignty is. Ask to the Spanish what national sovereignty. We have to regain sovereignty. Regain sovereignty on the European level. To defend our interest in a world changing completely. Every day. Competing with what? With China is not a nation. China is a continent. It's a civilization. India is not a nation. India is a continent. 2,000 ethnies, 20 different languages, 4 big religions. And then we still thinking in terms of 19th century. That is our problem. And I think you can make a case on that in the next elections and win with it. If you don't try, you can never win, actually.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah.
Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, non-resident at the Centre on US and Europe here at Brookings and senior fellow at the Centre for European Reform in London. I had a question on Britain's future ties with the EU. And I was wondering, to what extent do you think there might be willingness amongst other EU member states to allow the UK to renegotiate its current arrangement? And if it doesn't, and if it were to leave, how costly might this be for the EU? Thanks.
Yeah, this, an individual renegotiation of a membership is impossible. If you do that, you have 27 individual renegotiations and 27 different memberships in the Union. That doesn't work. We have already that problem for the moment at Europe à la carte. We have the Europe of the 6, the 9, the 11, the 12, the 15, the 17, the 25, and the 27. And in a few days, we are with 28. Yeah? The 27, you know, the 25 is the European patent. The 17 is the euro. Or you have the Europe of Schengen. You have the Europe of 9, that's to start an enhanced cooperation in the European Union. You have the Europe of 12, that's to start with a fiscal compact, and so on and so on. And I'm not speaking now this morning about the opt-ins and the opt-outs and the special regimes that exist. That cannot work. And so individual renegotiation shall only worsen that problem. What shall happen is a collective renegotiation about the treaty, about the fundamental law of the Union. When? In 2015, after the next European elections. We shall start again with the convention, like we launched it with the declaration from Laeken a decade ago. And what I hope that this negotiation can do is to discuss a fundamental law for the Union, so what the Germans are calling a Grundgesetz for the Union, and then every country can decide, like it was the case with the four states in 1787. And Rhode Island was the last who said yes to this. So the same has to happen also in Europe to make things clear and to stop this Europe à la carte who cannot work in the future.
You forget we had an attempted renegotiation in 1861.
Well, yeah, that was not very successful.
It was very decisive.
Not decisive.
Would you all thank the Prime Minister for his time, his candor, and his lucidity?